Turn with your and your Bibles with me to Psalm 39. Psalm 39. I said, I will guard my ways, lest I sin with my tongue. I will restrain my mouth with a muzzle, while the wicked are before me. I was mute with silence. I held my peace even from good, and my sorrow was stirred up. My heart was hot within me. While I was musing, the fire burned. Then I spoke with my tongue. Lord, make me to know my end, and what is the measure of my days, that I may know how frail I am. Indeed, you have made my days as handbreadths, and my age is as nothing before you. Certainly every man at his best state is but vapor. Surely every man walks about like a shadow. Surely they busy themselves in vain. He heaps up riches and does not know who will gather them. And now, Lord, what do I wait for? My hope is in you. Deliver me from all my transgressions. Do not make me the reproach of the foolish. I was mute. I did not open my mouth because it was you who did it. Remove your plague from me. I am consumed by the blow of your hand. When with rebukes you correct man for iniquity, you make his beauty melt away like a moth. Surely every man is vapor. Hear my prayer, O Lord, and give ear to my cry. Do not be silent at my tears, for I am a stranger with you, a sojourner, as all my fathers were. Remove your gaze from me, that I may regain strength before I go away and am no more. 1 Peter chapter 2. This morning, focusing just on two verses. They'll be related to the others that we'll look at as well, but I just wanted to focus on the 11 and 12 this morning. He's told us that we are chosen people, that we're the temple of God that He is building, and that it is our goal to proclaim the praises of the Lord. We're His special people. And as His special people, then obviously we're to live differently, respond differently to things. We're to be a witness to the world. Some people find it difficult to actually be a witness verbally. They feel like they need to have, you know, step-by-step instructions on how to witness. And there's nothing necessarily inherently wrong with that. But I believe a better witness is witnessing of Christ because it's who we are, that Christ has become so real to us that we just talk about Christ, we talk about the things of the Lord, and we don't know we're doing it. We are. And people notice and hear, and you've probably had that happen to you before, where someone has known you for a while, and then they make a comment about the fact that you're always talking about the Lord, or you certainly seem to have a strong trust in the Lord. You know, some comment, and you're thinking, when did I say that? And it's not that you necessarily said anything, it's that it's who you are. You're just living this way in front of people because you have become so absorbed with Christ. You're so filled with His Word, His mercy, His grace, His love. I mean, this is our goal, right? This is what we want to become. And there, as in our sanctification process, I believe that we do become that. So God uses words. He uses actions to share His mercy with a lost and dying world. And so our lives are evangelistic. Now, your lifestyle is saying something. It's either saying something good about the Lord or it may be saying something really bad about you. But your life is saying something. Your children are watching and they're learning from you. Your actions, your words, your decisions, the things that you think that you end up actually speaking when you probably should have kept them in your head. People find out who you are by being around you. Peter's going to address that here. We're in relationship with the world, but we're not in an intimate relationship with them. We have to be in relationship, right? Paul said it, if we weren't supposed to be here, we would have been taken out. But we're supposed to be here. We're just not supposed to be like them. And so we're in relationship with people. People that are lost, people that have strange ideas, maybe strange theologies. Their theology may be a particular party, a political party. They may have a theology of some variation on humanism. And you're in relationship with these people. And your theology is different. It's radically different than the rest of the world. They see that they pay attention to that. Sometimes they may want to debate with you about that and argue with you about that. And the fact that they're wanting to do that, by the way, indicates that you've probably lived and said something that has tweaked them. So that's not necessarily a bad thing if someone wants to challenge you on what you believe, because you've become probably a credible witness for the Lord. Because certainly he was challenged, Paul was challenged, anyone that followed the Lord and spoke of the Lord and the things of the Lord, it's so different than everything else. People are going, where'd you get that? Why do you think that way? What's going on with you? Why are you so different? Well, because I've been made different by Christ. I did not do this on my own. I did not seek to be different. I'm made different. The Holy Spirit is separate. God is separate from sin, and therefore when he's in us, it separates us from sin. It doesn't mean you stop sinning altogether. Then there would be no need for the confession that John talks about in his first epistle, but it does mean that we are prone to righteousness, if I can say it that way, in a way that we were not prone to before. Prior to Christ, we were only prone to sin. Now we have this ability to do things that are right, and not just right because someone says they're right, right because God says they're right, right because the Word says they're right. We're able to do that now. And if you got saved later in life as I did, you know the difference in the life you had and what you're now living. And this life that you're living now is because Christ changed you. Because if he had not, where would you be? I know where I would probably be. So here, Peter focuses on the fact that we are living in a world that is not our home, which I think is very important for us to keep in mind. And while we're here, we're to live honorably before the world. So two things I want to look at this morning. The negative side, we stay away from sin. And the positive side, we live honorably. This is long-term evangelism. This is not the quick knock on the door and try to get someone saved type of evangelism. This is long-term. This is a lifestyle that you live all the time, and then maybe one day this person you've been living this in front of says, tell me why you live like this. Tell me why you have hope. You know, the hopeless person that you know. I know some hopeless people. I know people that they think they're hopeless anyway. I know some, and you know some. And I long for that day when they say, why do you have hope? And how would they know I had hope? Because they had perceived that I was different from them, that I'm not negative and downcast all the time and constantly heavy and pessimistic about everything. Because if you have Christ, how could you possibly be pessimistic? I mean, that doesn't mean that we don't yearn for more righteousness in the world. We can do that, but that's different than being pessimistic and heavy and burdened and all of that. The wrong kind of burden. Negative. The negative side. Avoid sin. He says, beloved, verse 11, beloved, I beg you, or I beseech you, I strongly urge you, as sojourners and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lust which war against the soul. And let's just stop there for a minute. Sojourners and pilgrims. Two Greek adjectives that describe a person's status in the land in which they are living. Sojourners could be strangers. You may have that in your translation, temporary resident. But the interesting word is pilgrims. It's not completely different from sojourners, but this word is parapodemos. So we get our word parallel from para, means beside, right? So this means to dwell beside others. We're pilgrims. We're sojourners. We're travelers. But we're also dwelling beside other people. The world. People in the world. We're living next to them. They're our neighbors. So that's what this means. We are pilgrims. We're strangers in the sense that this is not our home. This is not where we're going to stay. It's a temporary residence that we're in. Our bodies are temporary residents. All of this is temporary, which is very important. I remind myself of this all the time, especially when things are getting tough. I just remind myself, this is temporary. This is a temporary time. This is not eternity yet, right? This is a part of it. The promise of eternity is in my life, but this is not it yet. There's an eternity to come. This is temporary. Sometimes it seems longer than other times. Sometimes it seems like it's just going by really fast. Other times it seems like it's slowed down to a crawl. But we're going to probably look back on this in light of eternity as a blip. It didn't last very long. It's temporary. we're sojourners, not our home. We're not to be building our own kingdoms. It doesn't mean we don't build a home and settle down and raise a family. Those are all biblical things. It doesn't mean we don't save money if we can and set it aside. But, I mean, the psalmist says, even though it's okay to set aside your riches, somebody else is going to end up with them. He says that over and over and over again. So, save it up. Just don't put a lot of stock in it. You know, just don't let that be your God. Clearly, the Bible keeps saying that. Don't let money be your God. It's all temporary, right? You're only going to have it for a short time. It's going to pass through your hands and end up in somebody else's. So it's not your God. It's not to be such a focus. Important? Sure. Absolutely. We need to pay our bills, right? That's part of living honorably as we work hard, we make our money, we pay our bills, we give to others, we are good citizens. So that's all a part of it, but it's not our God. And it's not the end. It's just a portion of our existence, a small portion of what, as a child of God, we're going to experience. Meaningful, yes. Again, it's important, but it's not the of ultimate importance. It's just a part of what God has purposed. We are pilgrims and sojourners. We're strangers in a land. Again, we should feel like strangers in this land because people don't think like us. They're making policies that we disagree with. This is not going the way that we would choose for it to go, probably in a lot of areas where you work, politics, whatever. You're looking at it, you're going, I would change that. Why would you change that? Because it's different than who you are. And so it reminds us that we are strangers here. We're pilgrims that live next to other people. Now, I want to look at something. Turn over to Hebrews real quick, just a couple of pages over, Hebrews chapter 11. Because our forefathers in the Spirit understood this as well. Here in the faith chapter, verse 13 of chapter 11 of Hebrews, these all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. Now, Peter's already told us that we're now the people of God, right? We're the chosen people. So we're just like Old Testament Israel. The believers of Old Testament Israel. We're all connected by the same faith, the same blood of Christ. His blood went right back there and covered their sin, but by faith they had believed, and so it was imputed to them as righteousness at that point. And the blood of Christ reaches back, and they're all saved through His blood. It reaches forward and saves us. And so they are just like us. We're just like them. Strangers and pilgrims on the earth. Verse 14, for those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. In other words, when we say we're strangers and pilgrims, we're saying, it's not my home. I'm headed for the heavenly city. I'm going somewhere else. In the meantime, I got some things to do that are important, but this is not where I'm staying. And so if I lose things, okay, Lord can replace them, right? I don't want, we're talking about houses burned down. I don't want my house to burn down. I never have wanted that, right? But if it burns down, y'all help me build another one, right? We'd all come together, we'd build another one. Your house burns down, we'll all come together, we'll fix it, right? It's temporary. We'll make sure that you're dry and you're warm and all of these things. It's all temporary. We'll all pitch in, we all make sure everybody's okay, but we also understand that all that stuff, as sentimental as it was, and you're not going to take it with you, right? Those photographs are important, but they're not going to heaven with you, I don't think. I may be wrong, but I don't think they are. So we got to be careful how tied we are. They were not. They declared that they sought another homeland. Verse 15, and truly if they had called to mind that country from which they had come out, they would have had opportunity to return. But now they desire a better, that is a heavenly country. Therefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for He has prepared a city for them. The Lord has prepared a place for us to live that is different from where we are. We are just like the folks that went before us, who believed in God, that it was a temporary home. And they declare by saying, I'm a sojourner and a pilgrim, I'm declaring, by not just saying it with my mouth, but by living it out, I'm saying this is temporary. I think that will say something to people. They may not, probably won't understand it. I think there are a lot of Christians who don't fully understand what that means. There's certainly the lost people don't understand what that means. But it might make an impact on them that you're not tied to the things of this earth. And I mean not tied in the sense of not talking about it necessarily. You show you're not tied to the things of the earth by how easily you allow them to go to someone else's possession as they need it, right? The Lord says that. Man asks you for something, you give it to him. You know, and I know there's within reason, and we've talked about that, and I'm not saying you be unwise and you block off your brain waves somehow and do something. You think about what you're doing. You're discerning. You're wise. But at the same time, there's a way to not be tied to something and still be wise in how you go about distributing. But you're not tied to it. And that's what's important here. We are sojourners. We are pilgrims. And if that's the case, if we've not yet received the promises, or they had not, it said, they'd not yet received the promises and still believed, and this world is not our home, and these goods are going to end up in somebody else's hands after we die, and it may be our children, but eventually maybe somebody we don't know, he's saying then abstain from fleshly lusts. So the reason now, not just Christ, not just because you're saved, not just because you're different, but because you're headed to a different place, then don't indulge in those things that are destructive. Stay away from them. Now, what's the implication? I mean, why would Peter even be saying this to us?
They were doing it, they were participating in this body.
We're prone. Yeah, we're prone to doing it. That's why he's saying it. As Christians, we're prone to do this. We're prone to lose sight of who we are and then end up indulging in those things that are of no value and even destructive, forgetting that this is not our home, that the things that are offered in this world are not what we're after. The fleshly lusts that are offered are not what we are to be focusing on. We're to not focus on those things. That enough will set us apart from the rest of the world. If you're the guy at the party that doesn't have a drink in his hand, what does everybody want to do? They want to put a drink in your hand. They do. I've experienced it. I have been the one trying to get somebody else back in the day. Why are you not drinking? Right? Because you didn't want to feel like they were different. Because it might judge you and your behavior. You need to be like us. Paul says in Corinthians, they encourage you to run with them in their dissipation. They want you to run with them. They want you to be like them. And they really want a Christian to do that because they don't want to feel nearly as bad as they do. So they want you to run with them in that dissipation. They want you to not abstain from fleshly lust. But if we're sojourners, if we're different, if we're pilgrims, people who live and dwell beside other people, but we're not them, then to abstain from fleshly lust is going to shine a light and it's going to separate us because we're not like them. We don't do what they do. And it might actually cause someone to ask you why. It's an interesting word that Peter has used there with I beg you. It's the word parakaleo. Again, a parallel word. It means to call alongside. Paul uses it a lot. Means to call alongside. So I found sort of an interesting thing here that here we are dwelling beside worldly people in the sense that they're our neighbors, but we're being called alongside righteousness, to walk in righteousness. So even though we are parallel in our dwelling, we're to be parallel in our walk with Christ. We're to be walking alongside those who are not a part of the world. So we dwell beside lost people, right? But we walk together in righteousness. We're called alongside one another to walk in righteousness because we're prone to not. We need each other. That's what it amounts to. We need the relationship with other righteous people, other people called outside, out of the world, to be able to walk together in righteousness. Because we're dwelling with those who don't, in the sense of being around them. So it's like this double parallel thing going. We need to walk together in righteousness while we're here. We're pilgrims together. We're all temporarily here, and we're all moving towards the celestial city. We're all on that journey. And while we're on that journey, we need to walk together. He's calling us alongside. He's calling them alongside himself, as it were. It's what Paul would do. Paul would say, basically, come walk with me. And that's what is being said here. Peter's saying, come walk with me. And so we could say the same thing to one another. Come, let's walk together. But his warning certainly implies our ability to restrain. We are able to do so. We're able to abstain from fleshly lust. We can choose to do that. Galatians 5 lists those fleshly lusts that we're to abstain from. So if you ever wanted to know exactly what they are, Paul has a partial list there, Galatians 5. And then most everything else that might be done could come under that particular rubric. So Peter is assuming here, I think, that believers could fall into sin. He says that the fleshly lust war against the soul. The word war comes from a Greek word meaning to serve as a soldier. And so the fleshly lust have taken up arms against you, is what it amounts to. It is a soldier seeking to destroy you. It has taken up arms against you, and it wars against you all the time. It's in the present tense. It's warring against you constantly. It is not a one-time thing. It is not an occasional thing. It is continual waging of war against you. Therefore, we must be vigilant. Well, Peter talks about, Paul talks about being vigilant and watchful, paying attention to what we're doing, where we are, the people we're hanging out with, right? We're dwelling beside the world, but we're not in an intimate relationship with them. We're called to be intimate related to those who are walking with Christ. That's the intimate relationship we're supposed to have. Koinonia fellowship, fellowship in Christ. The kind of fellowship that encourages and emboldens and leads us the right way, holds us accountable, these kinds of things. So we are being called to walk in righteousness, to abstain in the sense of staying away and saying no to sin, which is constantly badgering us, wanting to destroy us. It is wanting to capture us. The word that God used in Genesis 4 to Cain was the sense that sin wanted to have authority over him. It's the same word that he used when he said the curse of the woman was to want to have authority over the man. She wanted his place. That was a curse. She didn't want it before the curse. And then after the curse, she wanted the authority of the man, and she was going to be jealous of the position that the husband had, that the man had. We have that problem now. You know, that's the whole rise of feminism is basically the curse being fleshed out. It's the desire to be in control. God uses that same word to Cain. He says, sin wants to have authority over you, desires to control you. It is a war that we're in. Sin wants you right now. Sin wants to control you. So when we abstain from fleshly lust, we're not giving sin an opportunity. We're not giving ammo to the soldier so that he can effectively wage war against us. He's doing a pretty good job of messing with us without us giving him more ammunition. So as we abstain from fleshly lust, we're actually weakening the enemy. We're weakening the soldier who is against us. So never think for a minute that you're not under attack. You are. So Paul told Timothy, remember, to flee youthful lusts, to flee them, to run from them. In other words, they exist. He didn't deny that they existed. To deny that they exist, I think, is more dangerous than admitting that they exist and then dealing with it properly. It's dangerous to act to live in denial and act like it's not there, because more than likely, secretively, you're giving in. But when you're bold and say, I know it's there and I know I'm prone to that, help me, that's healthy. It is not healthy to hide. So that's the negative side. We are strangers, we are pilgrims, we are to abstain from fleshly lust, which are constantly trying to take control of our lives. The positive side is to live honorably. He says, verse 12, having your conduct honorable among the Gentiles, that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may, by your good works, which they observe, glorify God in the day of visitation. Conduct here, someone have something other than conduct? You might have conversation. Someone have conversation? You have conversation. You might have anything else besides conduct or conversation. Way of life, maybe? Well, that's what it means. It incorporates not only what you say, but how you live. That's what the word conduct means. The Greek word refers to both things. What you're saying and what you're doing. So they're saying basically what you say and what you do, it needs to be honorable. The word actually could mean honest, just simply being honest. One of the things that bothers me and bothers you as well is dishonesty. I found this out recently, and this probably shouldn't bother me as much as it does, but you know how one of those something that just sort of pokes at you, you just don't like it, and it doesn't bother anybody else, but it really bothers you? So I found out recently, and I'm sure all of you already knew this, that they'll sell you olive oil, not telling you that vegetable oil has been cut into the olive oil. Everybody else know this? Yeah. So they'll tell you they're selling you olive oil, not telling you that it's not pure olive oil. And they're able to do it. They figured out a way because, see, this olive oil is being imported. They don't have the same regulations over there as we do here. So they're able to say that it's olive oil, 100% olive oil, and it's really not. And here we're trying to avoid canola oil, you know, and vegetable oils that we know are bad for you. So we're switching to olive oil only to find out that it's quite possible we're being lied to. I am bothered by that. Don't tell me it's 100% olive oil if it's not. Tell me it's a mixture. Found this out. Didn't know this. Honey. Not tell you it's honey? They're putting corn syrup in honey. Did y'all know that? So if you don't buy raw honey or grow it yourself, you might be buying the very thing you're trying to avoid. By moving to honey, you're still getting the corn syrup, which you didn't want. This bothers me. Why lie to me? Because I might not buy it. I won't buy it. I mean, I'm looking at the label, right? It says high fructose corn syrup. I'm putting it back on the shelf, right? Don't want it. Don't need it. It's bad for you. This is me. Do what you want. I think it's poison. So you stay away. I want to stay away from this. I don't want to be lied to. Don't tell me I'm getting something I'm not doing. See, this is the idea of being honest. We're going to be honest. God says it is an abomination for you to have two different weights in your pocket as a merchant selling people something. You're not supposed to have two different weights marked the same but weighing differently. He says, that's an abomination to me. Why is it an abomination to God? Because it's dishonest. Because people will believe you. That's why I think it is okay for us to be bothered when people are being dishonest. Because God's bothered by it. We're to not be dishonest like that. We're not supposed to have two differing weights in our pocket so that we can rip somebody off ever so slightly on a little bitty basis where they won't ever find out, but we do that over a period of 10 years and, right, there's more money in our pockets, right? It's not okay. What is that showing? When we need to rip somebody off for just a little bit, what is that saying about us? Besides the obvious, what is it saying about our attitude towards God? We're not trusting Him. We're not trusting Him. God says, if someone comes and they want everything you got and they take it from you, you still trust me. We need to be honest. One of the biggest things, I think, the biggest problems we have in the marketplace is the fact that we have trouble trusting people who are selling us stuff. We have trouble with that. You struggle with that. So they have all of these, you know, warranties and guarantees and all of these things because somewhere along, you know, there was a time they didn't have warranties on stuff. Right? You didn't have a written warranty. They sold you a product. If it broke, you took it back and they went, oh, okay, let me fix that for you. They handed it back to you because they wanted you to have a product that was going to work. And now you've got to have a written warranty over everything because there's so much corruption. There's so much dishonesty in business. We need everything written. We need everything on paper. We need to sign everything. Everything's got to be done with a lawyer present, it seems like, because there's so much dishonesty. And that's on the consumer side, too. Consumers are, you know, I think, causing part of the problem as well. But the point is, we're to be honest and live honorably. We're not to, especially businessmen, anybody, but especially businessmen, need to be more concerned about the honesty in doing the transaction than in making the money. I think the money is a symptom of good, hard work and good ethics. Money, huh? Yeah, money's a symptom of that. We're not trying to get the money. The money will come. What we're trying to do is be honest. What we're trying to do is be transparent. Money will come. You don't have to worry about that. But when we're focused on the money, we'll stop being honest and we'll stop being transparent. And so businessmen need to care more about honesty in business than they do the dollar. They might lose a little money here and there. But you know, one of the things that I read about Sam Walton is back in the early days of Walmart, his return policy. And I think it's an actual quote from him. He says, if a man buys a pair of socks and they don't fit or he doesn't like them, when he brings them back, you give him his money back. That was his philosophy. You just give it back. Man doesn't want the socks he bought, don't make him take them. Give him his money back. And we see what happened to Walmart, right? It's exploded. It's global. It's a good policy to have. It's more important. And he certainly made lots of money with, and didn't have a problem with that. I think when he died, he was worth, what, $9 billion or something like that? He split up between his children. Did pretty good for a man that was willing to give you your money back if you didn't like what you bought. They still do that, by the way. Some people may have a problem with that. I haven't. I haven't had any trouble. I walk in, I've seen people without receipts get their money back. It's good policy. That's why we do business with them, a lot of reasons. Honest dealing. Treating people fairly. Both conversation and what we do. I think it has an incredible bearing on our witness to the world. Now, real quick, just to talk about Gentiles, you would think that if he uses the word Gentiles and he's talking about, then he must be talking to Jews specifically, and he's not. He's talking about unbelievers in general, because he's already said that he views us as children of the kingdom. We're the chosen people. And so he's not referring to people who would not be, in other words, non-Jews. He's just talking about unbelievers. He's using Gentiles as unbelievers. Paul does a similar thing in Romans chapter 2 and in Galatians 6 as well. And so, have your conduct honorable among the unbelievers, that when they speak against you as evildoers, implication that they will likely do this, we'll get to the other part in a minute about observing your good works. Let's talk about the speaking evil against you as evildoers. Paul says to Timothy, all who desire to live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution. People will speak evil against you. They will do things to you. Similar thing here. When they speak evil against you, or against you as evildoers, they will be able to not be confirmed in their belief about you when the Lord inspects, which is what that word means. We'll get to that in just a minute. There are men, even in our modern day, that have done things that dishonored the name of Christ, that dishonored their ministries. It has given fodder to unbelievers. People have spoken evil against them, and it's because they brought that up themselves. Their conduct was not honorable, and so when the unbelievers have spoken about them, it was true. I remember very clearly Jimmy Swaggart. Do y'all remember Jimmy Swaggart and his apology, his tiered apologies? Anybody remember that besides me? Yeah, I remember it very clearly. He had the microphone, his tears running down his face, and he's apologizing for his his bad behavior the first time. And he cried and he asked for forgiveness and they forgave him. The ministry forgave him and he continued on. And he did it again. The second time, he said, "Get out of my face. I'm not apologizing again. Y'all leave me alone. I'll do what I want to." So the first apology then was probably a lie. It's just an attempt to hang on. The second time, found out who he really is. Well, the unbelievers just ran with that thing for a long time. They just absolutely said, "Here's the reason I'm not a Christian. Because look at Jimmy Swagger," right? We have some others that have come up, right? Doug Phillips, Bill Gothard. You don't know about those. Mark Driscoll, Mars Hill Church, one of the largest growing churches over the last 18 years. It went from his living room, and back in, I guess, 93, 94, started as a Bible study in his living room, grew into tens of thousands of people, 15 different campuses, huge operation. Guy's reformed. He's Calvinistic. He didn't fall into sexual sin, by the way. I don't want you to get that impression, as Doug and Bill have been accused of doing, and Jimmy Swagger. No, Mark fell into something I think is even more insidious. Mark was heavy-handed, abusive verbally to people. Ran the ministry with an iron fist. This is from pastors who have been dismissed over the years, like something upwards of 30 of them that were dismissed because of heavy-handedness. They weren't conforming. This puts a bad, bad look at the rest of us. See, I consider myself reformed, obviously. We have it on our sign, right? I'm reformed in my understanding. Mark Driscoll and I could sit down at lunch and we would probably agree on everything theologically. But he got so big and he got rock star status. Y'all, I saw him at a conference and he was being treated like a rock star. And when you achieve rock star status, you're destined to a fall. See, this is not the kingdom we're building. Salary was $570,000 a year. Hello? That's just his salary. He made another $200,000 to $400,000 a year on books, or more than that, on speaking engagements and all of these things. And he mistreated people. He's trying to start up another ministry, it looks like. He's probably a decent guy. He probably just got overwhelmed and got over his head. I'm not saying he's the worst person in the world. And maybe this is the best thing. But you know what has happened now, based on what I've read, is now they're scrambling around, not knowing what to do. How can you have this many elders and pastors and they not know what to do when the one guy is gone and has to resign? What is that saying? Far too much dependence was on one man. Far too much dependence on this one personality. A very powerful personality. I heard him speak. He's powerful, you know, loved by a lot of people. But the world is saying, is this a church or is it a cult? I mean, that was the question. They got in trouble for church discipline, you know, because you got 15, 20,000 people and you're doing church discipline. I mean, you know, or trying. Small groups. But the point is, you don't have to necessarily fall into sexual sin for the world to be able to speak evil against you and it be true. Our conduct is supposed to be honorable, especially towards those in the household of faith, I would say. Gentle and kind and loving, right? Why? Because we're not trying to fix anything. Now, those are my words, and I keep saying them because we're not trying to fix anything. We don't need to fix anything. Jesus fixed it for us. We need to follow Christ. We need to follow His Word. He's done the fixing. We need to do the following. If people want to try and fix things, we can't do that. If we try to fix it, we'll probably mess it up. Doesn't mean we don't do things right. It doesn't mean we don't address issues. It doesn't mean we try to use the means of grace and the words that God has given us to make things move properly. Seek peace with all men, right? We're supposed to be doing these things, but there's a way to get it done. And we need to be careful. Very careful about falling into the category that we're incredibly important, and life wouldn't get along without us. We don't need to get like that. That's a dangerous sin. As far as I'm concerned, that's as fleshly as it can get. So, yeah, some of them are so clear. This, you know, the sexual sins, very clear. Obviously, you're not supposed to do that. And you've got this one, this brooding, you know, that you're not so sure. What do we do with that? And then it blows up, which is what's imploding is the word that they were using. It's imploding now. I think it's going to be fine. God's church is not going to be taken down by one man's misuse. It's not going to happen. But still, dishonorable conduct gives unbelievers opportunity to blaspheme the name of God. And they're taking it because they're looking for it. And so soon as they get a hold to it, they run it in the ground. Here's the reason I don't believe. Well, that's not going to do you very good when you stand before the Lord. You're letting a man bring you down. But what about those that speak against? Again, now, you want to stay away from fleshly lust because you want the evil that's spoken against you to be wrong. You want it to be wrong. You don't want it to be right. If they speak evil against you and it's wrong, you have no problem with that. But if it's right, you're going to get nervous. Your good works, which they observe. The word observe means to behold, means to inspect, means to see. So it implies that you aren't keeping your evil speaking away from you, the evil speaking away from you by hiding out in your home. In other words, you're not trying to shield yourself from evil speaking by living secretively so nobody can know what's going on. Your good conduct is seen, which means you're doing something publicly, not just privately. You're living your religion, your faith, your belief publicly. I was brought up, at least some philosophy that I was told by some family members, that Christianity is a private matter. It's private. It's a private religion. Never understood it then. Now I understand what they were saying, but it doesn't make any sense because it's not biblical. It's a city on a hill. How can a city on a hill be private religion? Right? How can the light in the room, the candle, how can that be private? It's very public. Right? It's very public. So our good works are being seen. They are observing them. Christianity must be taken into the marketplace. And those that say not are just avoiding responsibility of being a Christian. They're saying, I don't want to actually do this out there because I may get questioned. Somebody may ask me what I'm doing and I may not get invited to the party, you know, or I may not get in a particular business. Again, their focus may be on popularity or money or whatever the case may be instead of Jesus Christ and the importance of being a Christian. Because that's more important than popularity. Again, it's all temporary. So you get popular, so what? Right? Who cares? It's all temporary. It's going to go away. You're going to die. You're not going to be popular anymore. It's going to go away. Why do we care? But we do, you know. How many followers we have on Facebook, you know, and all that, it's all important. It's not important, right? It's just not important. If we're not careful, we'll think it is, though. They might be avoiding the cross that they are to bear when they're trying to make it a private thing. So we do our good works in the way that points people to Christ. We do them publicly. We show that we're different by what we do, what we say, how we live. And we will find a way to do these good works to the glory of God. Don't misunderstand the Jesus said, don't let the right hand know what the left hand is doing. Don't misunderstand that. Doesn't mean that everything you do is hidden. Sometimes people need to know what you're doing. Not that you're doing the fanfare, though, right? Because the writer to there's a proverb that says, let another man praise you and not your own lips, right? So it's okay for people to recognize that you've done something. The idea is don't go tooting your own horn. Don't walk around going, did you see what I did? Have you seen what I did? Did you see this? Right? I've had family members that did that all the time. If they did something, they went and told everybody what they'd done. They wanted that pat on the back. It's unbecoming, to say the least. But when other people say, did you hear what so-and-so did? Did you see that good work? I saw this good work, and I want you to know what I saw. Well, that's okay. You can't stop you from doing that. As a matter of fact, they're going to observe it, and they're probably going to talk about it. And they will be responsive in some way. They certainly will be affected. The word visitation is an interesting word. It's actually the word episcopo. We get our word episcopal from that. We get our word bishop from that. Bishop. You know what a bishop does? Oversees, right? It's an overseer. So, what is the day of visitation? Or actually, the definite article is not in the Greek, so it could just be a day of visitation, just any old day. It doesn't have to be the day, as in the final day. It's probably not. As a matter of fact, if it were, it'd probably have a capital D. So it's a day of visitation. So what could he be talking about here that God, in the day of inspection, in the day of overseeing, is what it amounts to? When God comes to inspect, that they might glorify Him. Well, if it's just any old day, then what it amounts to is the world, unbelieving world, is observing your good works. God somehow, if it's not on the day, but just a day, God focuses, shows His approval. When He has seen your good works in some way, He will show His approval in some way to you and maybe to the people that have seen it. In other words, He may open their eyes to see that your works are honorable because He is an overseer. He has come to inspect. He has visited. He's come to see. Right? So He's making His presence known in your good works. Now, if it's the day, you know, like the final day, then it'd be a day of judgment, as it were. So when He judges the unbelievers, they will see that they were wrong all along and that you were right. And they'll glorify God. However that's done. People that actually are gnashing their teeth at Him. When the unbelievers gnash their teeth at God, brings glory to Him. He's glorified in everything. He's even glorified in the anger and hatred of men towards Him. He's glorified in all things. He creates the vessel for destruction, according to Romans 9. And He does so for His own glory. So He is glorified in all things. So it could be a day where God just simply blesses you in a way and shows His approval to you as one of His servants in some way. And I have no way of deciding how that might be. It could come in so many different ways, but that could be what He's talking about. When God sees, and not just sees, because He sees what you're doing, right? But He shows that He's seen what you're doing. He inspects the work. You've abstained from fleshly lust. You have been honest when you didn't have to be. When only God was watching. You've been honest. You've been honorable in what you said and what you did. The way you run your business, the way you treat your children, the way you speak to your neighbor. You've been honest. You've been honest about all things that you do. And God sees it. Sometimes those things are in secret. He's the only one that sees. It's just between you and Him. God will bless you, He says. He says, I will bless you openly when you live like this. He doesn't always do it when we want Him to. He does it on His timetable. That's why I think He's talking about when God decides to show up. God will show up in your life at different times. Put His stamp of approval on you as one of His children. So I think it can mean that as an ongoing thing, and I think it probably could mean the final day when the Lord comes to judge all things, that your conduct, as they spoke evil against you, you will be vindicated in your righteous behavior. You will be vindicated. A lot of times you're living what you think is right. You're trying to do everything right. People don't notice it. People are mistreating you, and you're going, but I'm doing everything right. You know, I said the right thing. I did the right thing. I'm being honest in everything. Why is everybody still out to tell me what a bad person I am? Because that's what they do. That's what they do. And so we don't turn to them for their approval. We don't say, I need your approval. We say, God, I want you to be approve of me in what I do. He's already approved in the sense that He saved you. That's serious approval. By calling you out of darkness and into light is putting a big stamp of approval on your life through Jesus Christ. And now we live in a way that pleases Him. And then they won't have anything bad to say. They can say it all they want to, and it will not be true. Some guys can't say that. Some guys can't say, you're speaking evil against me and it's not true. Well, it is. It's been shown to be true. You think God's in control of that? Think God's in control of these men being found in? Everybody should be doing this with their heads right here. Yes, God is in control of that. God's in control of these men being found out. Is he afraid of that? Is God threatened by that? Obviously not. God's so unthreatened about it, he told us about David, the apple of his eye. And we know all of the weaknesses of David, the apple of God's eye. God's not threatened by that kind of stuff. As I said before, one man's not going to take the church down. God's going to be victorious because he's God and he's not dependent on men. I am so glad he's not dependent on us. Would we not fail him miserably if he were dependent on us? Yes, we already have failed him miserably and we would continue to do so. He's not dependent on us. But he does bless us when we are obedient. It's inherent. It's part of it. You don't have to ask for it. You live in obedience, the blessing is there. You live in disobedience, the curse is also built in. It's there. So these men cannot say, some of these that we've spoken about, and there are lots and lots of others just like them, the evil that's being spoken against them is true. We need to live in such a way that the evil spoken against us is not true. And if it is true, and you do it long enough, God's patience will run out. He says he will not bear with you forever about your sin, and it may be you're the next one exposed. Certainly won't be as on a big a scale as someone like Swaggart or Phillips or Mark Driscoll, but it'll be just as devastating to you as a person. Well, I want to stop there and give you an opportunity to respond or ask a question. John.
I want to put something out there. I just wrote this actually in a letter to the paper. I think it's not just the businessmen, but it's also the workers. The workers have a responsibility before God also to do their work well before God. They're required to do that with a good spirit, the right attitude, and the right frame of mind. And God actually says, if you do this, I will bless you. Look at Deuteronomy 18, right? Follow my law and the way you do your work will have a reward for it. So it's not just the businessmen. Workers too, all of us. In other words, it's applicable to everybody here. When you go to work, even if we're not the boss, we still have a responsibility to honor God in our work, through our work ethic. I'm going to throw that out there.
Absolutely. Yeah. We need to work the time that we have been paid for.
You know, I often wonder, too, is if we watch the American economy kind of deteriorate, and it looks to be about the same rate, if you will, that workers have stopped hearing that. So in other words, I think it's when workers, Christian workers, begin to take their work seriously again before God, that might just mark the turn of America's economy to go back in the right direction, because we're applying the right principles to the way we work. Yeah. Maybe not actually Obama's fault, not that he's not part of the problem, but maybe it's actually our fault for not following God in our personal lives.
Hmm. Another thought and question. Oh, Dan, I'm sorry. Can't, this is better.
Remembering that it refers to Gentiles, and as you said, it's not just Gentiles, but Jews also, those who are not believers. I think it's significant that it says that when they speak against you instead of if they speak against you. Because the fact is that they have a presupposition. And it's a cover for their own sin. That they're not as, they don't do such and such. They're not as bad as so and so. And they kind of presuppose that Christians are not really any better or living a better life than they are. So when they speak against us as evildoers, it's not based on fact, because it says, then they may, by your good works which they observe, glorify God. Their speech against us is not based on fact. It's based on a presupposition, the fact that they are excusing themselves from sin. And so they are going to speak against us. It's a given. It's not if they, it's when they do. And so we can expect it. And it's not based on anything factual. It's part of their problem.
Well, that's the idea. We don't want it to be based on anything factual. We want them to not be telling the truth. And this doesn't have to be every single person in your life, right? Every single person in your life is not speaking evil against you, but you've probably got somebody that's speaking evil against you somewhere, even if they're not doing it to your face. It's probably somebody trying to undermine you. We always seem to have somebody that doesn't like us, don't we? Maybe even a dozen people. They have no particular reason. They just don't like us. They decided they're going to hate us. And it may simply be because of who you are in Christ. And not anything that you did, just who you are. Jesus Christ didn't do anything except all right things, you know. They just decided they were going to hate him. I always refer back to the fact that he says, you call me a drunkard, a glutton and a wine bibber because I'm eating and drinking. But John the Baptist came and he didn't live like this and you rejected him too. So you're just rejecting people because you're going to reject us. It has nothing to do with what we're doing and how we're doing it. You just decided you're going to reject us. So even if you do everything right, you know, you're going to have some who are going to eat and drink, some who may abstain from eating and drinking. But if both of them are walking with Christ, they're going to be rejected because of Christ. So do everything you can, but again, don't think that's necessarily going to mean it's all kudos and ice cream. Could be bad. Anyway. That's why we need each other. See, that's why this group is so important. Not just this group, but the other Christians in your life. This is why this is important. Because, see, the evil speaking that happens here is called gossip. It's sin. We can deal with that biblically. But if evil speaking out there, you can't stop it except just don't let it be true. Let them be lying.